netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. It's award season once again, and this week we're going to talk about the Scientific and Engineering Awards that have already been announced as part of the Oscars. And in fact, we're going to focus specifically on the light stage. The Academy announced that Paul Dubcevic, Tim Hawkins, John Monos, and Mark Sager, John of Sony Picture Image Works and Mark of Weta, will be honored with the Scientific and Engineering Academy Award for the design and engineering of the light stage capture devices and image-based facial rendering system developed for character relighting in motion pictures. If you've been following FX Guide, there's several articles. In fact, if you just go to the search on fxguide.com and search for light stage, you'll see several of the articles. And Mike and I have been on out to see Paul and different variations on the light stage over the past few years. So if you want to get some background before you listen to this, there's some great articles on there about that and pictures showing some of the light stages. This is a really cool award, and it's also been over the 10 years since Paul's first 2000 SIGGRAPH paper. Five of those years have had Oscar-nominated or winning films helped by the light stage, the ICT light stage. Also, while we're on talking about the Oscars, I wanted to say congratulations to Luke Dolan, who was the director, and Drew Bailey, who were nominated for Best Short Film, Miracle Fish, which I'm proud to say FX PhD helped to make. In fact, Mike Seymour was the visual effects supervisor, and it was shot with our very own Red Camera number 22. So let's jump in now and talk to Mike and Paul Dubcevic.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Mike. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
So, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's terrific that the Academy is honoring not only you, but the other members of the award. Can you talk to me about, obviously, the Motion Picture Academy has decided to award this to the four of you. Could you explain the relationship between the four of you?
Absolutely. All of us, myself, Tim Hawkins, John Monos, and Mark Sager have all, played a role of some significance in the history of these light stages and getting them used in motion pictures. And it's been a relatively interesting process going back to. There's even some footage from the fall of 1987. That I shot of myself on an 8mm movie camera.
And don't you look like a nice young lad?
My goodness. I look like someone who didn't have anything better to do with his evening that night. Just trying to move a light around my head as I tried to stay still.
But you're trying to move the light on yourself, right?
Yes, basically. So you can imagine how well that went in terms of getting registered data. But I certainly enjoyed watching that footage and just seeing how different a face can look as you light it from different directions. And kind of the ideas of, well, how could you actually record some data set of how a person reflects light? And then I got a chance to revisit that as a postdoctoral researcher at UC Berkeley. And followed on the work that I had done in basically developing HDRI image-based lighting techniques. And the interest was, well, we can use image-based lighting to light computer-generated objects. What if you wanted to light objects that are in the real world? How can you do that with, light probes that you've shot? And there was a very interesting thing that happened right after SIGGRAPH 99, which is the year that I and my team had the movie Fiat Lux in the SIGGRAPH Electronic Theater, which showed a lot of image-based lighting results in St. Peter's Basilica, various kind of simple CG objects, spheres and monolithic slabs and stuff like that. And there was another movie that was done by Pacific Tidal / Life Effects that a fellow named Mark Sagar was involved in. It was called The Jester. And it was this sort of trippy film with this extremely impressive, for the time, digital face of a young woman in a jester's cap reading abstract poetry. And it was a bit of a big wow to the audience, because for me, when I first saw that, it made me believe, we are going to get to photoreal digital faces. It's not a matter of if, it's going to be a matter of time. So I was a huge fan of that film, and a few weeks after SIGGRAPH, I got an email from Mark Sagar saying that he really liked seeing Fiat Lux, and he was wondering, hey, maybe we could do something that has some of your lighting techniques with some of our facial animation techniques, and we could do something that kind of works together in an interesting way. And I was just thrilled to get a chance to talk to the fellow, and I even flew down to Los Angeles. I was up at Berkeley at the time to have a couple meetings with him where, you know, he showed me what he was doing, and, you know, it's clear he knew a lot about how faces move and what's important to get right to make them realistic. And based on that, I decided, you know what, we're going to do the facial relighting project. We're going to do it here in the fall of 99, and we are going to build a real device that is able to capture how a face reflects light. And what I did is I took basically the people from the team that had made Fiat Lux, which included Tim Hawkins and a couple of undergrads, and we started going over to Home Depot and getting lumber and then ABS plastic tubing, and I got a 250-watt Lowell spotlight. And we found various ways of hammering these things together, so eventually we could spiral a light around a person's face and capture, you know, 4D reflectance fields, you know, light stage data sets of people lit from every direction that light can come from. And as it turns out, if you have this kind of data set with a person lit from, in that case, it was actually quite high resolution data from 1800 lighting directions, it's a pretty simple matter of just scaling the color and intensity of the color channels of each one of those basis images according to the color and intensity of the corresponding directions of light in the environment in your HDRI map, adding them all together, and it actually lights the face with the illumination that you recorded from somewhere else. And it was a fun paper to write up and submit to SIGGRAPH.
So now, Tim has actually currently got a company actually called Lightstage, doesn't he?
Yes.
And of course, you got together with Mark and presumably John on in about, what, 2002, when you were on Lightstage 2 for Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tim I've actually known for a long time. We actually met at the University of Michigan when I was doing computer engineering and he was doing aerospace engineering, and you know, we were you know, put in the same dormitory, and had a chance. We were both from slightly out of state. He was from Wisconsin and I was from Illinois, and we were both paying about five times as much tuition as anyone else around there. So we had stuff to chat about. You know, in the Light Stage 1 project, you know, Tim was great to have on there because he's one of these people who, you know, can help with the physical stuff, you know, carting the wood around and nailing it together, and then turn around the same evening and code up some really great algorithms for figuring out, you know, the occlusion maps of the reflectance functions and figuring out ways to render a specular lobe from viewpoints that you didn't actually originally record. So once we project the light stage data onto these 3D models, we built a rudimentary face scanning system inside of it. We could actually predict how the specularity would shift around and be seen from different angles. And Tim had a very nice technique that was data-driven of observing the speculobe from one direction, inferring a microfacet distribution, and then re-rendering that using all of the original data to novel camera viewpoints. Hmm. And you know, we had hoped, the hope was actually that as soon as I got down to the ICT, which is, you know, in the Los Angeles area, that's where Mark Sagar was working at Life Effects, they were calling it, that Mark and my lab would be able to start collaborating immediately, because for the SIGGRAPH 2000 paper, Mark had actually shipped us down the motion capture data of the moving mesh of Jessica Valeau from the Jester animation. And if you look in the SIGGRAPH 2000 paper that we did called Acquiring the Reflectance Field of the Human Face, the female subject there is actually Jessica Valeau, who was the motion capture actress and facial model for Mark's Jester animation. We intentionally, you know, actually flew her up from Los Angeles and scanned her for this, because we were going to animate her with the Jester animation.
Right.
As it turns out, the whole project was, you know, just had already become such a huge project, and, you know, it was like a 12-page SIGGRAPH paper just with the image-based relighting and the novel viewpoint generation. So we had left off the animation part for a follow-up. And then things unfortunately ground to a halt for about 2 years because I had some initial meetings with Mark Sagar, and we were all excited to get back to work, especially using Light Stage 2, which we'd built and gotten ready for the opening of the Institute in September 2000. But then, as it turns out, there had been some bad blood between the person who used to be the head of our Institute and the person who was running Mark Sagar's company. And I don't even know what the issue was, but we were told, nope, can't work with Mark's company. And so that was just kind of a big bummer because we were all set to, you know, really try to, you know, have a drop-dead photoreal face based on light stage data and motion capture, you know, submitted for SIGGRAPH 2001 or 2002, and it just wasn't able to happen. Then the dot-com bust hit, and LifeFX, which had been targeting internet applications, and it had some very, very impressive quality facial animation for, like, real-time web browser stuff, mm-hmm. you know, it just wasn't one of the companies that was able to survive that, despite the great technology that they had. And, you know, Mark looked for other places, and he ended up getting hired at Sony Pictures Imageworks. I think that was around 2002. And that was a great coincidence because the light stage process of rendering digital faces had attracted the attention of a visual effects supervisor over there named Scott Stockdyke, who was trying to figure out how are we going to do the digital stunt doubles for Spider-Man 2.
Now, was John already at Sony at this point?
Let's see here. So John Monos, I don't know if he was at Sony the earliest parts of it, but he certainly ended up becoming a significant player, just like Mark Sagar did, in applying the and adapting the light stage relighting process to digital characters for Spider-Man 2. And he was part of that team as well.
Because John was on Spider-Man 1 as well as Men in Black 2 and other things. So I think he's already at SPI, I think.
So then he definitely would have been there already. So Scott Stockdyke had seen the research and wanted to give it a shot. Coincidentally to that, they hired Mark Sagar, who we wanted to work with anyway. And in late 2002, they brought over a test actor for us to scan in Light Stage 2, and that was the first time that we got it all synchronized up to motion picture cameras. They were actually Aeroflex 35mm film cameras overcranked to 60 frames per second, so that with the 30 strobe lights on that semicircular arm of Light Stage 2, we could get a 480 lighting direction data set in 8 seconds at film resolution. And that was very exciting for us because we'd never captured light stage data at anything significantly higher than Sony Handycam resolution. And that just changed the game entirely.
Now, Light Stage 1, as you said, was built like on a shoestring budget with a bit of wood and a rope that turned it round. Light Stage 2, I actually got to sit in when I visited you a couple of years back, and that's actually quite a big set. And for those that don't know, Light Stage 2 is large enough for an actor to sit in. It's not like the one we may have seen with just a head scan. This is like a full actor sitting in a chair, much like a dentist chair, in an entire rig, isn't it? It's quite large.
Actually, the headrest did come off of a dentist chair, as it turns out, to help people stay still. And it's a full 3 meters in diameter, so, you know, it totally, you know, you're all the way down to your feet, you know, it's below your feet and it goes around there. So you've got a good standoff distance from the lights. And it's, you know, it's pulled around by real motors and it has some real inertia to that. We generally, you know, spin it around so it takes 8 seconds to go around. The motor can run it actually at about 40 RPM and you feel very nervous being in the room when it's doing that.
But like Light Stage 1, at this stage, the principle was still to have an arc, if you like, a slice that would rotate around rather than being a full sphere that you would sit in.
That's right. We basically went from, you know, a point in Light Stage 1 to a line in Light Stage 2, and then with Light Stage 3 on, we've had full spheres of illumination.
And if the technology from Light Stage 2 went into Spider-Man 2, which, of course, I think you had on about 40 shots, and that went on to win the 2004 Oscar, I believe, for Best Visual Effects. Obviously, the Doc Ock and Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man being, I presume, the two principal areas that you're focusing your attention on in the film.
Definitely. That Doc Ock is used more because you actually see his face in the film, and sometimes he's got sunglasses on, sometimes he doesn't, sometimes he's far away, and sometimes he's actually quite close up in frame. The scene with him falling down into the waters of the New York River is a digitally rendered face. They didn't think it would be safe to submerge the real guy with him pretending to act like he's dead. And so they did that in CG and had a reason to do a full-frame close-up of a digital face, which held up pretty well. And for Spider-Man, in the script, Tobey Maguire's mask is off for a scene where he's stopping a train. And so his light stage data set got used to render onto the CG body. And for Sony ImageWorks, to get this to work, they had to do quite a bit of stuff. They had to implement the image-based relighting process, working on full resolution, I think 2K scanned film frames, which, you know, you can see skin pores and all that nice detail in there very clearly. But they also had to get it to interact with CG elements, traditional CG elements. They had to be able to put sunglasses on the face of Doc Ock and have those sunglasses, which are a total traditional CG element, cast shadows appropriately onto image-based reflectance properties. And they figured out how to do that. They basically changed the lighting environment that every single one of those pixels of the face is rendered with, depending on whether, you know, the sunglasses have blocked a principal light source or not. And the really cool stuff that, you know, Mark Sagar and the team that he led and John Monos, who was able to make a lot of this stuff into reality and get it working in the tools, was something that a digital artist could move a light source around in their lighting program on the digital Doc Ock and not even have to worry about which parts of that character were captured in the light stage and being rendered using an image-based process and which parts were traditional CG elements.
So now, while John continued on at Sony ImageWorks for things like Superman Returns, which also used this, you actually had effectively Mark heading down to New Zealand and yep. become involved with Kong, presumably.
Exactly. And, you know, Mark is natively from New Zealand, and it was, you know, time for him to head down there. I had the idea that it would be, you know, great, and he talked to Joe Letteri about using this process on Kong, and pretty much with a relatively similar time frame, the folks doing Superman Returns decided, well, let's use that process that works so well for Doc Ock, and let's do our digital stunt double of Brandon Routh for Superman Returns using the process. And the two shoots actually happened a little bit differently. So for Kong, they brought over Naomi Watts, and I had the suggestion on some of the phone calls, you know, hey, it would be really cool, don't you think, if you shot it on digital cameras? Because I'd actually seen some Viper Filmstream cameras in action, and I thought this would get some very nice data to work with. And we wouldn't have stabilization issues, for example, after it got scanned. And Joe Letteri said that was a good idea and then asked me, so how about, can you just arrange that we have all those cameras ready to go when we show up with Naomi Watts? So all of a sudden I'm on the phone with the very good people at the camera house to see if we can get four Vipers in the same room at the same time, which was a little bit of an ordeal. And the camera house totally came through getting those. And
Tim still with you at this stage?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, so much of this, you know, Tim was very involved in getting Light Stage 2 built. And, you know, every time we had some new kind of camera system in there that we had to figure out how to synchronize up to the strobes, you know, strobes are require considerably more care and feeding than LEDs, for example. So every single time we did a light stage two shoot, it was a bit of a production to get everything in sync and make sure stuff was firing and the voltage levels were right. And Tim was great at getting, you know, just making sure that technically we could accomplish each one of these shoots. The Viper cameras got set up, and they brought over, you know, four HD monitors just set up, you know, one next to the other in vertical format. And they shot one frontal, one a little bit below front, one from the right, and one from the left of Naomi Watts in, you know, several different facial expressions. One set with jungle makeup. They actually flew her makeup artist up from New Zealand as well to do that. And the thing that I remember the most from that shoot was standing behind that control panel with essentially 12 square feet of Naomi Watts live in front of me from four different viewpoints. Like each one of these monitors showing her four times life size, you know, just 30 frames per second live in high definition. It was just the strangest experience to be that close to somebody's face, but still have it be, you know, a digital experience. And the data itself definitely definitely reflected that. The Superman Returns shoot was different. It was very different in character because it wasn't Sony Imageworks working for Sony. It was Sony Imageworks working for Warner Brothers. And so the whole, you know, nature of the shoot, given that there was another level of client considerations there, made it, you know, we had to take everything a lot more seriously and be on absolute, you know, strict good behavior in all possible ways. But for that, they actually brought in six film cameras, which is sort of ironic because,
given that the rest of the film was shot on HD.
Exactly. It was shot with the Panavision Genesis, and I think that was when, you know, every Panavision Genesis in existence was somewhere in Australia shooting the film. And then they since they simply wanted to go with what they knew from the Spider-Man 2 process, they brought in Aeroflex film cameras at 60 frames per second over cranked again. They put the ones in the back so they wouldn't have to turn them around and get misaligned data for the backsides of the neck. And they scanned it at 4K this time to get even higher resolution textures. But as a result, for Superman Returns, the real actor was shot digitally, and the digital actor was shot on film.
Now, Kong would go on to win the Oscar for Best Visual Effects. Superman Returns was nominated for the Oscar. But you're still on light stage 2, if I'm not mistaken. It's not until we get to Spider-Man 3 that you guys move to light stage 3. Is that correct?
That's true. But actually, most of what we did for Spider-Man 3 was still done in light stage 2. And if you go down to the room where, you know, light stage 2, which we don't use anymore, you know, the tape marks on the floor actually still all say SP3 from where the Spider-Man 3 tripods were placed. The Superman Returns results were definitely some of the best that Sony Imageworks produced in the whole history of this process. And, you know, they were, you know, to a certain extent good enough that it wasn't known as much as it could have been of just how much digital character work there was in that film. I recall being at some panel at the Egyptian Theater, and there were, you know, seven panelists all ready to talk about cool stuff that happened in Superman Returns, and there was plenty of cool stuff happening in the effects in that movie, and they had saved John Monos for last, so he was going to talk about how the digital Superman face was done. As it turns out, there was just so much to talk about before they even got to John that they basically, you know, they'd run over time, and they gave him like about 4 minutes to actually present what at the time was certainly the best results in digital characters that had been achieved. So people were a little disappointed. I don't think the story got out as much as it could have. One of the most interesting things about that is that they actually had shot quite a bit of footage of Brandon Routh on green screen that they had intended to composite in to you know, background plates, either, you know, digital sky domes or plate photography, that, you know, when they got to the compositing stage, they had, you know, the typical issues with some shots where, you know, he just wasn't lit quite right to belong in that scene, or they weren't entirely satisfied with the camera path that the motion control gave them going around the, you know, the poor actor hanging on the wires and or on the table. And they realized that having scanned all the light stage data at 4K and you know, John having led the effort to do as good a job as possible on the digital character, that they could just take the digital Superman, put him in the scene and recreate the shot and actually throw out the green screen footage, throw out the footage of the real actor and just recreate it in CG. So there were plenty of digital character shots with, you know, the face quite close to camera that just got replaced in that way. And it showed the possibility of, if you have, you know, digital characters, a lot of the problems that you have with the traditional filmmaking process aren't as big problems, because you can relight it in post-production. You can change the viewpoint in post-production. If there was an issue with the timing of the performance, or once it's all edited together into the scene and that particular, you know, emotional note that they're striking with their face doesn't quite ring true, you know, you've got animation controls and you can actually address it at this point.
And of course, this is, as we said, like leading up to the Spider-Man 3, but also Hancock. Because, again, if you said that perhaps some of the work in Superman wasn't perhaps acknowledged by the community, I don't know quite enough of the work in Hancock was also given much attention in terms of the digital work that you guys did.
Yeah, Hancock was a very interesting show because it was sort of in a... it was in a transition period where we weren't really using Light Stage 2 anymore to shoot this kind of data. There was a desire on the part of ImageWorks to still go with the relatively traditional one light at a time reflectance field data sets for the digital characters. In fact, what they were interested in doing was something that we hadn't even really had the ambition to do even in our own laboratory in terms of rendering faces from data, which is that they really wanted to get an exhaustive data set of Will Smith and Charlize Theron, not just from every direction that light can come from, but from every viewing direction that they can be seen from and in stereo for each one of those viewpoints. So this ended up being a very interesting shoot where we used our Vision Research high-speed cameras, the 1K by 1K Phantom V5s, which is the one camera that it would have been physically possible to get in time and actually put 10 of in the same room running together. I don't think film cameras we could have gotten that many going. And they made five stereo pairs in a special rig that Nick Nicholson rigged up from ImageWorks that looked at the actor in stereo from above and you know, down to the equator, and then actually you know, from about knee level as well, poking into the geodesic sphere of light stage 5. And then we would capture in about 2 seconds each of those 156 lighting directions on the actor, and then rotate them a little bit and capture it again, and rotate them a little bit and capture them again. And this generated, of course, an enormous amount of data, but it was, you know, in a very principled way, a way that just through view interpolation and image-based relighting, you could create your digital character. And, you know, in the film, when they're flying around as superheroes, again, those are digital faces that are rendered using the image-based relighting techniques.
Yeah, I mean, just astounding. And I guess the thing is, by way of, to illustrate how significant the research has been in terms of certainly the Oscar winners, we actually skip a year, because it's about one of the few years that you weren't involved in an Oscar nomination, to get to what has to be one of the greatest pieces of facial animation ever in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And I believe now we're to digital domain, and they actually built their own system, or did they use your ICT Light Stage 5?
They actually came over here and we fired up Light Stage 5 for them. So basically Eric Barba and his team you know, found themselves you know, with the task of, you know, creating the first very significant you know, digital human performance of a major character, where the digital face isn't going to just be used for stunt sequences, but scenes with significant dialogue and emotional requirements of the performance of the character. The Superman Returns face, you know, it looked great close up, but when it was close up, you know, Superman, you know, he didn't deliver lines of dialogue. He didn't go through, you know, significant emotional range. He's a relatively even keel kind of fellow, and he's quite focused on his job when he's flying around. So there was no need for that. In Benjamin Button, they had to, you know, do much better than that, and do something that really fully qualifies as a digital leading actor in a film. And this was a project where they didn't want to create a version of the actor, of Brad Pitt, that looks just like Brad Pitt. For those scenes, they're just going to film Brad Pitt, and there are scenes where he's, you know, close to the age that he really is. They were going to do it with makeup, or they would, you know, use some of the digital image editing, some of the awesome work that Lola does to accomplish those effects. But to make him look like, you know, sort of the old man, that's where they needed to do the fully digital head, and they had Rick Baker's makeup studio. In particular, an amazing sculptor named Kazu Tsuji sculpt the head of Brad Pitt as if he were an old man in silicone, and then paint it, put in little whiskers, glass eyes, wispy hair, all of the things, so that when they showed up in our lab and pulled this sculpture, this maquette, out of the box, it was, you know, a full-on, totally...
A decapitated older Brad Pitt, basically.
Exactly. Yes, they pull a head out of the box, and then we very gingerly edged it into light stage 5, got it up on a tripod in there. And what they had asked us to do is get light stage data sets of this thing, one light at a time. There's 156 light sources in light stage 5. And get it from basically all the angles going around, from straight on to, you know, 45 degrees sideways, all the way around. And this was nice because it was practical to use our digital still cameras. We use Canon 5Ds at 12 megapixels to shoot the data. And we could do that because now we have a subject that doesn't move. And we can take... 12 minutes to shoot all 156 photos and get very high resolution, you know, very nicely exposed data for that.
It's remarkable, you know, because if we now go, because we think about what they did on set, like they were using different HDR scans for different rooms and transitioning between those, but also they were compositing that head into shots, thus effectively using your work as the real picture and to see if their digital picture then kind of matched it, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly.
So you've now become the benchmark for reality as opposed to, which is quite ironic in a way.
It's nice that, you know, the image-based relighting process that you get with light stage data, it's just exploiting the laws of physics. You're showing the face in a lighting condition that never technically existed on it, but, you know, the linearity of light transport and the superposition principle just means that if you add two images of a head lit in different lighting conditions, and if it's done in radiometrically linear form, we use the raw images for this, of course, then it actually gives you the right answer as to what it would look like with both lights on. And if you tint the different images first, then it shows you what it would look like with, you know, a warm light from that direction and a cool light from that direction. And if you extend that to the whole sphere, you can relight the head to look like it would be in any lighting environment. And the digital domain team realized that it would be extremely key to be able to pretty automatically just get the lighting right on this digital head, because they had 325 shots to accomplish with a full 3D CG head. And, you know, they did not have an infinite budget. They didn't have an infinite number of people. And they just simply weren't going to have time for their excellent lighting artists to start from scratch every single shot to try to replicate the illumination. And furthermore, you know, a human head is a very familiar object, so we're sensitive to how light plays off of it, and we're familiar with how light plays off of it. And the scenes in Benjamin Button are not you know, flying through the streets of Manhattan. They're not, running
through
jungles.
Superman up in sort of low atmosphere flying. He's walking through a room.
Exactly. These are incredibly down-to-earth scenes that we have a lot of expectations about what a human head should look like in these scenes. And he's very often interacting with totally real characters, sitting right next to them on the couch, where you have a perfect lighting reference of what a real person does look in that environment. So they needed a technological solution to get themselves, you know, at least 90% there just by, you know, using the software. And they built, Jonathan Litt and Tadao Mahashi put together, and several other folks, Paul Lambert as well, and I'm sure I'm missing a lot of people on the team there, but these are the folks I interacted with the most, put together, really one of the best image-based lighting pipelines that has ever been used on a film. And it was actually interesting that many of the techniques that I had developed for Fiat Lux to get the three-dimensionality of the illumination within St. Peter's Basilica and to get the sampling problem solved, because St. Peter's had, you know, very sourcey small light sources coming from the windows and the spotlights and the vaulting that caused terrible noise issues when I just, you know, fired up traditional image-based lighting techniques in Radiance. I had to map each one of those light sources into a small area light and have that simulated directly using the image as a way of measuring the color and intensity that direct light source should be. They had a great system for doing that, and so that as the digital Benjamin head moves around, they could actually have the lighting on him change appropriately for how he moves around in the scene.
And of course, I guess the other thing is from the early days when you were shooting on film and therefore sampling inside the range of presumably a DPX 10-bit log file, by the time we're getting up to Benjamin Mutton, you're fully able to work the maths as floating point in OpenEXR files. It's the maths is no longer being sort of in any way clipped or compromised. It's really a very pure implementation, isn't it?
Absolutely. They have a full floating point workflow there. They work in Nuke. I believe they used Mental Ray to render a lot of this data. So it's all in floating point. It was done by people who know what they're doing in terms of having a truly linear workflow, getting the various color balancing issues there. Matching film curves, getting glare and motion blur to work correct in high dynamic range. And what their pipeline was, it was actually very interesting. There's in the big coffee table book about how Benjamin Button came together, there's this mosaic of images, of pairs of images of Benjamin Button's head that were rendered as tests. And on the left side, in the middle is a tiny little thumbnail of the light probe image that was shot. On the left side, it shows the light stage data that's been recombined with image-based relighting to appear as if lit with that light probe. And then on the right side is their full 3D computer-generated model, their animatable rig that can do all the great animation things that Steve Prigg made that able to do. And it's lit with image-based lighting with high-resolution geometry and subsurface scattering shaders, and they wanted to prove that their animatable 3D head model would respond to light the same way as that real maquette would respond to light. So as you were saying, the maquette and the light stage process was used as the ground truth that they wanted to prove that all of their shaders and lighting techniques would produce on the digital head. And they ended up using that image-based relighting process not just as validation, but also as part of their lighting workflow, so that if, as a digital artist, you know, brought up a shot and had to light it, the first thing that they could look at using this neat Nuke plugin was the texture map data of the maquette relit and projected onto the three-dimensional animated face.
I just think this is fascinating because at this point, the benchmark, as you say, of reality is no longer, because there is no, this is the whole point, I guess, there is no made up actor walking around on this set as your reference. This is the advanced version of having a thing on a stick that you walk through shot to tell what the lighting should look like. It was like their baseline of where to start was what other films earlier would have had as their almost final output.
It's actually, you're absolutely right on that. And that's what they did. They had the light stage data of the maquette. They would project that onto the geometry, see how that animated. We had actually shot those lighting data sets, both cross-polarized and unpolarized, so they could solo the diffuse channel.
Oh, really?
And just look at that without the shine of the skin, and pick which data set they projected on, and get a real sense of how the real face would behave in the environment. And that's just very fast. The new plugins essentially, close to interactive speeds for that. And then once they, do whatever artistic adjustments are necessary to the lighting environment, they can start seeing what the expensive mental ray renderings look like of the fully animated, very high resolution digital mesh would look like. And in this case here, since the head had to do so much animation, the traditional light stage process would have been significantly taxed to provide that kind of detail, because we didn't have the opportunity to scan the maquette in different facial expressions. It was only in a neutral expression.
Hmm.
And to get convincing facial animation out of the image-based relighting process, or the traditional light stage process, we would have had to start with many different expressions and build the facial rig and the reflectance from it.
Which segues incredibly well into Avatar, because at two levels. One, because you again used the polarizing effect so that you could separate specular from diffuse. But secondly, because unlike Benjamin Button, you actually had the actors back in the light stage, didn't you?
Yes, definitely. So the Avatar project actually goes back to pre-Hancock and slightly even before, I think, some of the Spider-Man 3 work, certainly before Spider-Man 3 was out. And it's based on a light stage face scanning technique that's actually different than everything that we've talked about before, and different than, I think, what specifically the Academy is citing for in this particular award. But it's the process that we designed so that we could actually get high-resolution, three-dimensional geometry out of the light stage, and not necessarily as detailed reflectance information for doing image-based relighting. So we don't turn on one light at a time, but we actually capture digital data sets that are much more the kinds of things you would put into a traditional shader, a diffuse map, a specular map, and normal maps and displacement maps, so you can build your digital character that way and then use, for example, image-based lighting to create your final renderings.
So Avatar very effectively uses this to work on, and we spoke to the guys down there on the project, but they basically, I mean, would it be fair to say that they have taken this research as far as it has yet done on film? Because not only were they doing this, of course, they were rendering it in stereo, but that the performance level required and the sheer number of digital actors exceeded that of even Benjamin Button. And it was just, I mean, it's...
That's absolutely the case. I think that for, doing a photoreal, human lead actor character, I think that Benjamin Button is still the gold standard for that. But for having such an extensive number of characters driven with performance-driven animation, all of them, making it solidly to the other side of the uncanny valley, with the one slight caveat that, they're not quite human. The skin is obviously a very different color than human. The facial shape's a bit different than human. Avatar definitely takes all of this to a new level. And, for us and our involvement in there, we scanned five of the actors using a couple of different processes, as well as a considerable swath of the Home Depot garden department that they brought over to get texture reference and spec map reference and surface normal maps of different plants that would resemble the things that would be in the jungles that they were building. We just have to kind of take a step back and be humble about the fact that we were a you know, just a small part of a very large, very incredible operation to create those final results on film. But the reason that Joe Letteri, I believe, got interested in using these techniques is that he wanted his artistic teams that had to create these Na'vi characters to really have the best possible data in existence that was conceivably possible to capture of what these real actors' faces were shaped like and how the real actors' faces you know, reflected light, what their texture maps were, as much as that could be captured through photometric techniques, you know, of their skin structure. And the scans that we got of Zoe Saldana and Sam Worthington and Joel Moore, Sigourney Weaver, and Stephen Lang. Yes?
I was going to say, because you also did Stephen Lang, who obviously wasn't a digital Na'vi character. Yeah.
I'll mention him in a moment.
Sure.
He just wanted to get, you know, the data that we're able to get in the hands of their artists to make whatever use it was going to be for being able to build those characters. And they also did things to get, you know, even higher resolution detail of particular parts of their faces, you know, through face casting processes as well. And, you know, amazing artistic effort to take any certain thing that we did and transmogrify it 10 levels before it became the eventual character that you see on screen. But the data we were able to provide was definitely something that got used in the process. And, you know, not just the neutral positions of the actors, but this new process we have, it only takes 3 seconds to capture an actor's face at 10 megapixel resolution with normal maps, with diffuse and specular maps. And for the first time, we could practically get actors in many different expressions. We got, you know, Zoe Saldana, you know, with her mouth wide open, like, you know, she's, you know, screaming at Jake Sully, and make all of that data available of how her skin stretches and how, you know, her bones deform her face in that particular kind of expression. And it would be very hard to get those kinds of scans with all of that data, you know, using a face casting process for that.
You said you'd come back to the fact that some of the actors, such as Stephen Lang, weren't actually being used for an alien virtual digital double.
Exactly. So it was actually very interesting when I finally saw the film, because all of a sudden, who we scanned and in what positions and why finally became clear in Joe's master plan. And Stephen Lang does not have a Na'vi version of himself, but as it turns out, he is a digital character in the film in quite a number of shots in the film. And I actually had to have these pointed out to me by people at Weta when I was down there in November as they were finishing the film up. But quite a lot of shots, for example, in the final battle sequence where Colonel Quaritch, his character, is in the amp suit, and fighting Jake and Neytiri, they just go to a photoreal digital double of the fellow. And the, you know, texture maps and the geometric reference and such that we had, that was part of what they used to build up those digital characters. And also, you know, an absolutely excellently created and very innovative image-based lighting pipeline that they built for the film as well, to try to get the lighting on these things to look believable.
So Tim was obviously with you, and Tim was key in doing the scanning of the actors, of Sam Worthington, etc. But also, presumably, this reunited you with Mark, because Mark's at Weta and, of course, on Avatar.
Yeah, Mark is a huge reason that we actually had the opportunity to be part of this. I found out that Weta would be working on Avatar, that they'd essentially gotten the job to do the Avatar effects when I was in Boston at SIGGRAPH 2006. I was sitting at the booth for 2007. Mark Sagar comes by and he mentions this, and he also mentions that he's going to be flying back to New Zealand through LA. He'll be in LA for a few days, and you know, wondered if it would make sense to drop by the lab. I said, you know, we've got kind of this new light stage capture process that you might be interested to see. And, you know, we just had initial results, but we put images on the screen that showed we were getting this detail of the skin textures, you know, with this, you know, photometric capture process. We were getting, you know, detail that was starting to get to the level of what you could get through digitizing plaster casts of faces just using photographs. And within a few weeks of that, I think, he had communicated this to Joe Letteri, who said, you know, send Zoe and Sam over to their lab. Let's see what they can do. So it was actually in late 2006 that we did our first scans for Avatar. This was especially convenient because they were shooting all the motion capture for Avatar just about 2 kilometers from our research institute here. So when we improved the process, it was not even much trouble to have Zoe and Sam come back and get shot with the faster cameras and the brighter lights when we had them.
So, Paul, it was 2000 that you published your 2000 SIDGRAPH conference paper on the light stage. In the 10 years that's followed, 5 of the films that were either nominated or won the visual effects Oscar had actors that went through scanners either on your stage or you worked with the teams, which is, of course, you know, a huge part of why the Academy is honouring the 4 of you with a technical Oscar. I've enjoyed this walk down, but I just would love to know, at what point did you become aware individually that you were up for consideration? Because it is a great honor, and it's a great chance for the industry to say thank you back.
We found out about it this fall, basically, that the Academy was interested to hear about the techniques, hear how they had been used in films, and, you know, consider it potentially. You know, given that, you know, it had been around for a while and it seemed like it wasn't going away anytime soon. So basically, you know, I had the honor of, you know, giving a very distinguished group of people a tour of the technology and a PowerPoint presentation about how things had been used. I'm very, very grateful because, you know, just to prepare for this, there was so much support from the people in the visual effects industry who had made use of this technology, from Sony Imageworks in providing, you know, film resolution finals of the Doc Ock sequences and the Superman sequences, Scott Stockdyke, Peter Knopfs providing a lot of useful things. Numerous visual effects supervisors writing letters explaining how the work had been used and what difference it had been it had made in the productions, and just having a lot of support for the Academy to consider this, and, you know, a couple follow-up phone calls, and then a little bit of a wait, and then, you know, the understanding that someday you're going to get a letter to you know, hear what they decided about this, and opening it up, and you know, having the chance to read a little bit of good news one afternoon.
Well, as I say, on behalf of all of us, congratulations and thank you for you and the guys for all the work. As this will go out on the 19th, it'll be tomorrow night that you put on the black tie, and because the technical Oscar, engineering Oscars, actually happen on the 20th in a separate event. So I hope you enjoy the night and have a chance to sit back and kind of celebrate in what is just, after all, an acknowledgement of a lot of people's hard work and very, very successful, I would say, a research project that clearly built on itself over a long period of time. It wasn't just one aha moment, but it's been just such an interesting thing to watch over this last decade as the technology and the research has developed. And I hope you're about to tell me that it isn't over yet.
You know, we still have an operational light stage down the hall, and I think if I were to go over there, even though it's a little late at night right now, I think people are doing some experiments with it. So we're going to try to keep going here.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mike. Much appreciated.
Well, thanks, Mike and Paul. For Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.